welcome and good day to you all. Welcome to the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources for Thursday, February 24, 2005. We've sort of, as you know, we had instituted a fine structure of which the chair now is liable.
For you?
No, I'll pay my own fine. In reality, we're going to the chair is going to keep track, and we're just going to figure out kind of what to do at the end of the session. Okay?
Oh, you've got to be kidding!
No.
You Ways and Means people really are into.
Oh yeah, we're all right. So. It's 25 cents for every incident of where you're not here by the time that the meeting is supposed to start and the gavel comes down. So we're going to have a little fun with that, and hopefully it'll all go for a good cause in the end. Is kind of what our intention is. All right, welcome. We have in front of us the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Welcome, Director Shetterly. It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to be
here. And you have with you is Christina. Very good to see you. And why don't you go ahead and get started? What we want to do today is we want to have your agency overview piece, and then we'll probably just go ahead and get right on into performance measures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I will do then, for the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, what I will do is present some prepared remarks that give you kind of an overview of where we are in particular with the department in this biennium. And then I'll be happy to accommodate whatever interests you have in going through performance measures, asking questions as I go. I'm flexible. Before I begin, I'll just introduce who I have with me, Teddy Leland, on my right, your left, from the department. Teddy is the manager of our Operations Services Division with budget oversight. In the middle, Bob Brindy, our legislative policy analyst, and then to my left, your right, George Naughton. George is on loan to us on a management development job rotation through the courtesy of the Department of Administrative Services, budget analyst there, and we are very pleased to have his expertise on budget and management in the department. And, very beneficial. He's been with us since January. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yesterday was the first anniversary of my start at the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and so some of my comments are retrospective on that year, personal retrospective, but I think also of the department. When the governor asked me to assume the reins of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, he gave me three very direct charges. That were to me, to the department, and to the Land Conservation and Development Commission, of which five of the seven members are new themselves within the last year. Those three charges were to better connect the department and the state land use planning program with the governor's statewide agenda of economic development, that is, make the planning program and the department partners with local governments, cities and counties across the state and their constituents in fostering sustainable economic development across the state, rural as well as urban Oregon. The second charge to continue the work that had begun in what I would call really the culture of the department and addressing our relationships, particularly with our local government partners and the kind of work that we did with them, making sure that we were facilitators and assisting local governments in achieving their goals relative to the land use and planning program. And then third, relating to one of our policy option packages in Senate Bill 82, which I'll just touch on briefly for this presentation, is the 30-year review of land use planning to put the program on the table, ask the hard questions about it, and be prepared for the answers, and then be prepared to amend our land use planning program to bring it in line with our current values, our current objectives, and to make the system more transparent and accessible. I'll just go back and touch on those three charges, again, economic development, the culture of the department, beginning with those two. In terms of economic development, there are some big picture things that we have been engaged in under House Bill 2011 from last session. We have for the first time a team devoted to economic development planning in the department. These are folks who work with cities in particular in their Goal 9 strategies, helping them develop economic opportunities analysis, helping them implement those and recognize how they can use the land use planning program more effectively to foster economic development in their communities. That team is overseen by an Economic Development Policy Advisory Committee that's chaired by Margaret Kirkpatrick, one of our LCDC commissioners, that has on it some very strong representatives, not only of government, but also, most critically, of private sector economic development interests. They've been active for the past year and really has helped focus the department on its charge to economic development. We also at the department have been key players in the governor's economic revitalization team. I take that responsibility very seriously as a director, and I have conveyed that same sense of responsibility for participation through the department, and we do a good job. We are active team members in the regional teams through the economic revitalization team. And we meet regularly on a state level as well, and have seen some good things through the economic revitalization team efforts. We were key players in the Industrial Lands Task Force and the certification program that has evolved from that. In fact, again, Commissioner Margaret Kirkpatrick was the chair of the Industrial Lands Task Force. And so that, too, has helped provide us with an orientation toward economic development that is more focused than has historically been the case. Some specific things we've done in economic development in the last year. We found ourselves without a conditional use permit process for small aggregate mines, which was a critical need, especially for ODOT in going into its bridge construction projects. There was a case that came out of Douglas County called the Beaver State case that basically ended what had been an informal conditional use permit process for small aggregate mines, which are often the kind that are used for projects, highway projects in particular. We amended our rules in the last year to reinstate that CUP process for aggregate mines, so those are available now for local governments, counties in particular, to cite and to authorize. We are engaged right now with the Department of Transportation in a review and amendment of the transportation planning rule in response to another Court of Appeals decision that imposed fairly strict what we call concurrency standards on development that would have said, in essence, that the improvement of transportation facilities had to occur within a close time frame to in construction of new development, particularly employment facilities, commercial and industrial. The TPR amendments that we are doing are designed to better facilitate development by relaxing those concurrency standards so that they don't put a burden on that development. We just finished a goal amendment regarding sewer service to rural residences. That's not specifically an economic development tool, but it certainly is important to local communities in the rural parts of the state, giving them better access to sewer service from which they have been excluded in the past. We are revising our Goal 14 to streamline the urban growth boundary expansion process to make it easier for cities to expand their urban growth boundaries and provide buildable lands for residences and for commercial and industrial. And we are also amending Goal 9, which is our economic development goal, to clarify for cities what their responsibilities are in terms of providing economic opportunities. Yes.
Question by Representative Shaw.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. Yeah. That's why I called you. It was about the sewer hookup.
Yep.
I couldn't remember. They made it so you're within 300 feet you could. Why just 300? Why not? What if somebody's 1,000 feet and they're out in the boonies or somewhere out in the suburbs? Why just 300?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, probably the best answer to that was in working with the special districts. We did this in conjunction with Burton Wiest representing special districts and recognizing the balance between providing sewer service to rural residences but also being constrained in encouraging sprawl and overdevelopment. That was basically the line that special districts thought was appropriate that worked for us. And frankly, it could have been 350 feet, could have been 250. There's no particular magic to it, but that was the number that worked for special districts in particular, and they were the ones who were interested in having this ability to connect. I'd like to address, again, in brief, covering these initial charges, the culture and the way we work in the department, and I've been most pleased this past year to see developments and to hear responses from our local government partners on this. If I can give you the sort of the big picture of this, of course, the department is a regulatory agency. Certainly that is part of what we do. But the emphasis, even before I started, but certainly I've maintained it and tried to strengthen the emphasis in this last year, is to promote not so much the regulatory per se, but to emphasize the role that we have in facilitating. We have the state's experts on our land use planning program in the department, and we have the ability to put that expertise to work to help local governments achieve their objectives. And I think if I could, during my first 9 months, I traveled across the state. I think the information is that between my first months and a little bit before, we covered 32 of Oregon's 36 counties in visiting with local governments, cities, and counties. And I can tell you the perception that is out there among much of the state, and I'm sure a lot of you won't be surprised, is that that of the department as the traffic cop of the land use planning program, that is the picture of the police officer who parks the patrol car behind the bushes beside the road, waiting for the hapless or careless or inattentive driver to come by a few miles over the speed limit, hit the sirens and lights, and you write that ticket, and that's how you discharge your obligation. And that's one way, certainly, to approach regulatory function. We have emphasized a change in that to much more the community policing model, where we expect our people to be out in communities, in city halls and planning departments and courthouses, attending public meetings, and working with our partners, using our expertise, recognizing that we have a regulatory function, but that we can best serve our local government partners by being out there with them in their communities and helping them through some tough spots. And I want to give you some examples of that, because we've had some great ones this year that I take a lot of pride in. And some of them have been in your neighborhoods. Representative Krieger and I spent a good part of a sunny, windy afternoon on the beach at Gold Beach. We had been apprised of the situation there where the city had enacted a comprehensive plan amendment that was done without all of the procedural niceties and had been informed that they were about to undertake construction of a residential development on or even past the hazard line on the beach, Sebastian Shores in Gold Beach. That came to me about a week before I was scheduled to travel down to the South Coast, and we did send our letter from the Department of Justice that says you can't do that. But rather than stop with that, it was a great day to be down at the City Hall to meet with the planner, to meet with the mayor, the developer, developer's representatives, and some other folks from the city, and then with our coastal representative to actually walk down to the beach with maps in hand to see exactly what it is that they had in mind to do. And in about, I don't know, a half hour or so on the beach, we had determined that, in fact, they were about 99% fine with what they had planned on. They had some procedural issues that they needed to correct. They recognized that. And so we went back after that and actually helped them rewrite, rescind the resolution that had inappropriately amended their comprehensive plan, helped them rewrite the appropriate resolution. To my knowledge, that development must be underway by now. And I was so pleased to get letters of thanks from the city planner, from the developer, and from the developer's local representatives down there, all of whom expressed a sense that they had never seen this kind of attention from the department before and assistance. What could have been a year or more in appeals and I think difficult relationships we were able to resolve just by going face-to-face and meeting with the folks and finding out what it was exactly that they needed. They recognized our limitations and were able then to work together. Senator Nelson knows about what's gone on in the last year in the West Umatilla County area. That's an area that was, I think, shocked when the word came that the Simplot plant was going to be closed and saw their industrial base being put at risk. And they came to us with the county for help in designating lands out there, sizable parts of the area north and south of Hermiston, as industrial and commercial, so that they could continue to recruit and then develop their base out there. And we spent, I would say, probably 6 months working with the county and with the city and actually helped them get there in an ordinance that approved an exception area of more than 1,000 acres of industrial land to the south of Hermiston and more than 300 acres of commercial on Highway 395 to the north. And just to bring you up to immediate date on this, I got a phone call this morning, a voicemail on my phone from one of the attorneys that represented, that was involved on behalf of the city or the county in that case, who just had it in mind to call and say that they were so pleased with the work that we had done with them in helping them get this, that if there was any help that he could provide in the legislative session in terms of support, to let him know. And that was an unsolicited offer on his part from a representative of that local government. Those are the kind of things. I'll give you one more, and then I'll move on. Malheur County, another area of the state that is in desperate need of economic development. You may recall that the governor was very active in recruiting Treasure Valley Renewable Resources, a biofuels refinery, to the state from Idaho. And as it turned out, the location for that facility, where they wanted to go, where Malheur County wanted to put them, was going to require a comprehensive plan amendment to rezone and allow the site to locate there. We had our staff, our regional representatives involved in that, and our specialists, and assisted the county in actually rewriting or developing the comprehensive plan amendment to facilitate the location of that biofuels refinery. That's the kind of retail in the courthouse kind of work that we do. And what developed from there was an appeal from some local citizens who were unhappy with the county's work. And in fact, that appeal came at my very first LCDC meeting last year, and I thought it was a tremendous opportunity for us to show one more level of commitment, and I requested, and the commission agreed to allow us to participate in the appeal of that case by filing an agency brief with LUBA in support of the county's action, so that we actually not only helped them at the front end in developing the comprehensive plan amendment that allowed this to be located, but also followed through to LUBA using our resources and our expertise to express to LUBA that we believe this was a case where the local community had gotten it right and that this was an opportunity for the land use program to appropriately facilitate economic development. In another very closely related case, although different part of the state, in Jefferson County, much the same kind of thing. It was the location of a feedlot. Not a lot of employees at the feedlot, but it did involve a big marketing opportunity for that region of the state in terms of the cattle industry. We again helped the Jefferson County with their code to make it possible to locate the feedlot where they wanted. That again was appealed by some local citizens, and again we filed a brief in this case on behalf of the county with the Department of Agriculture is on that appeal as well. And I'm pleased to say that in both cases, both Malheur County and Jefferson County, we were successful in supporting the counties and the work that we had done with them. I know we need to get on to some other things, so I won't carry on, but I'll tell you that in those snapshots, those express the commitment that this department has and that I have personally as director to following through on the governor's directives to connect our program with on the ground with his objective in support of economic development. We believe we can do it. We've been successful. There are certainly challenges ahead, but we are committed to continuing. I mentioned my travels around the state. That's been one of the best things, the best uses of my time, and has been very well received by local officials and, frankly, private citizens, where we've had an opportunity to meet with them, going in and sitting down at the courthouses and city halls and meeting halls around the state, and how appreciative they have been of my time and by extension, the department's attention to their local interests. And it's been an eye-opener for me to hear from commissioners in Grant County and Curry County and Klamath County, as well as, of course, the metropolitan area and up and down the valley, but all around the state, the perspectives that they have. I'm still doing that. 2 weeks ago, I was in Medford to meet with some folks up at Shady Cove, yeah, and just out at Jacksonville. And last night, I was down to speak at the Rogue Valley Council of Governments dinner in Medford. So I think that being the evangelist and traveling the circuit has really begun to pay dividends in terms of our relationship. And if I could just go to one more. We had a recent dust up in Jackson County over ballot measure 37. I don't know if you saw the headlines down there, but I was shocked. The headline in the Mail Tribune and the article that followed was about the feud between the county and the state. I'm very concerned about that because I was unaware that there was a feud. So I picked up the phone and I called Commissioner Jack Walker. We had a very good conversation when I was down 2 weeks ago. I spoke with Commissioner C.J. Smith. We got ourselves back on the same page, and frankly, it was no feud. There was the potential for a misunderstanding, but there's nothing like personal contact to settle that. And I was able then to write an op-ed piece for the Mail Tribune that sort of closed the loop and told the rest of the story that, in fact, we were not at odds with Jackson County on the Measure 37 issues, that it appeared that we might be. As you can tell, it takes a lot of care and feeding to maintain this new relationship and this new paradigm at the department, but I'm committed to it. And the staff has really taken to it. Again, they have the expertise, and these are folks who know how to use what they know about the program to assist our community statewide. And frankly, it's energizing. It's a lot more fun to do that and get those letters of thanks and emails expressing thanks and gratitude than what you can sometimes engender when you just exercise that pure regulatory role. And so I think morale is good. Sense that we have a mission here and that we're fulfilling it has been very gratifying to see. The commission itself also is engaged. We are taking the commission out on the road in the last year. Just a little over a year, we've met in Ontario, Hood River, Klamath Falls, La Grande, Astoria, and Portland. And this fall, assuming that we can get out on the road after session, we expect to be in Bandon in September and Medford, I think, in November. But that's been good, too. It gets the commission out to see the different parts of the state. And we always have roundtables wherever we go so that we bring in local officials and invite them to spend sometimes 2 or 3 hours in just informal conversation with the commission, educating them and, frankly, giving the commission a chance to fill them in as well. The third, I've covered economic development, I've covered the new culture and our relationship with local governments and our constituents. The third I mentioned just briefly is the 30-year review of land use planning. That, again, is expressed in Senate Bill 82. I understand we have a hearing set for that down in the Senate, and that basically sets the stage for putting the program on the table. And asking, as I said, the hard questions. Here's what we intended to do with the program 30 years ago. Did we do it? Have we achieved it? Have we achieved some unintended consequences along the way? Are there things we simply should quit trying to do, and are there some things that we should be doing better? We are hoping that through this process of review, not only can we conduct an evaluation of the program, but also get to the point where we can get through the 30 years of statutory enactment and rule promulgation and goal amendments and case law that have made the system so obtuse and so hard for citizens and local governments as well to understand and to work. And we are hoping then through this process to get to a system that is more transparent, that it's easier to navigate, and we'll, through that then we'll be more effective, because we all know that a system that is difficult to understand does not breed trust and does not breed a sense of confidence.
Representative Dingfeld, we have a question.
Thank you. Yeah, and thank you, Lane. It's so good to see you back in the building.
Great to see you. Thank you.
And I wanted to, you know, the way I look at this is, and I think you sort of alluded to this in your discussion, that we're in this transition between sort of a regulatory program to more of a technical assistance in helping communities to meet state goals. But two questions I have. One is regarding periodic review. And, you know, I don't hear this complaint necessarily from my city, but when I worked in Washington County with 16 different cities, I used to hear quite a bit about the periodic review process. When you're out there, are you still hearing about that as sort of a hang-up with the state? And then I have a second part of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder. Timely question. Yes, but I'm hearing more echoes of it than current issues, in part because of Senate Bill, was it 543? 920 last session, but even before that, the legislature has, over the 99 and again in 2003, reduced the impact of periodic review on cities and counties. And so, again, when I say echoes, right now, for instance, cities under 2,500 are exempt from periodic review under Senate Bill 920 last session. For cities under 10,000, there are no new work tasks. That's a moratorium that will sunset in July of 2007. And so the din, I think, has quieted, but the work has not. We have just completed a work group involving local governments and, again, private sector folks, as well as Commissioner John Van Landingham, that will be making a report and recommendations for changes to periodic review. Better focused, using the economic revitalization team to identify communities that are experiencing or about to experience growth where planning will be needed, so that we're focusing the planning where it's going to be most important on the ground. For the metro area, I think extending the timeline from 5 to 7 years for periodic review to give them some more breathing room. So yes, we hear that, but again, I think that in combination with the legislation that has passed recently and these recommendations for reform, I think we're getting a handle on periodic review.
Thank you, Lane. And just a follow-up, I'm assuming that will be part of the 30-year review process. You'll be looking at the efficiency or effectiveness of periodic reviews, and I haven't looked at your performance measures yet, but I would imagine that would be a good one to look at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder. It would be part of the 30-year review, although I will say that was one that I think was critical enough and was of sufficient interest from the legislature last session that we've gone ahead with that. We've not put that on hold for the 30-year review. We've done the recommendation and we'll be making the recommendations for changes even in this session.
Chair left. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Substitute Chair. Where are we in periodic reviews? I mean, you probably can spell these out. I mean, I'm just curious because I know you know, set before your time, we were way far behind, and I'm just curious as to if you can just give the committee a sense of the backlog.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder. I would call your attention to Exhibit J to your materials. It is the report to this session on the status of periodic review. The upshot of it is that we have cut the backlog down to the bone, and we are much more timely on our end with periodic review. Again, that's in part because the flow of work tasks into periodic review has been slowed as a result of legislation, but also because we put a high priority on working the periodic review work tasks that we have. So, again, the report is there as Attachment J. The results are actually very good.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, your question.
Thank you, Lane, for all the good work you did in Hermiston. This culture thing with the agency has always been a big concern. I think this committee, hearing all these other agency bills, we recognize that as a problem in other agencies also. We have sort of a sense that that you're not really being consumer friendly, which I think we're in. This is a new phase. Maybe 15 years ago, that wasn't the way it was supposed to be, but now it appears to me with this economic development issue, we have to be that way. When you were talking about the Hermiston area and the development, and I applaud that, I was thinking that, and that's on one hand, this is one agency. I just received a letter yesterday from a letter from an attorney in Portland about use of water out of the Columbia River from Melinda Eaton, who is the chair of the Northwest Power Planning Council, who basically said, we want to put a moratorium on taking any water out of the Columbia River water. Well, with your agency going out and trying to encourage development, if that Hermiston area, and I'm sure there's other areas in the state, don't have available water, and they're in the critical groundwater area now, how do you work together with these other agencies? How do we solve that problem so that, you know, you do a good, great job, but somebody else comes and says, oh, I'm sorry, we can't get this done?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson. It is an excellent question, and frankly, in the one of the things that I picked up in my travels around the state when I talk with particularly county folks about the 30-year review, I think there's a real strong sense that we need to better connect water availability, water resources, with the planning process, because I think there historically has been a disconnect. And so in the long term, there is that. It's also a timely question. I just spent 2 hours last Friday morning with the County Planning Directors Association getting a report from Tamara Mabbott and Carla, Morrow County planner, on their situation. It was an eye-opener. Phil Ward was there from Water Resources. And they've engaged us. I can't tell you what the outcome of that will be, but they certainly have our attention on the water needs. Again, our connection to water in LC, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, is not as direct as it is in other agencies, but frankly, that may be part of the problem, too, that we have a decentralized approach, I think, at the state level. And whether that's through the 30-year review, whether that's through governor's economic revitalization team, I think we can all do a better job of coordinating our respective agency policies toward water needs, because in the future, that's going to be the name of the game.
It's followed by six, goal six, you talk about air, water, and land quality, but we don't talk about quantity.
That's right.
I mean, to me, that seems to be a lot of the problem.
Lane, let's dive into Measure 37
sure.
a little bit, because it's obviously a really important issue to your agency. You're working on a report on Measure 37. Is that right? Is there some document about the process of how it works, or
Mr. Chair, we're not working on a report. I got some numbers to update you in terms of where we are,
okay.
And maybe I will just spend a couple minutes
on 37
yeah. and just tell you what's going on. When the measure passed, we were engaged immediately in the development of a claims process that is in place. We had it in place before December 2nd, in time for the first claims to come in. The way that is working at the state level, the Department of Administrative Services has been designated as the lead agency for receiving claims. All claims go to DAS. And it sounds counterintuitive at the beginning, because we expect, and in fact reality is, that the great majority of these claims, in fact, are claims that are related to DLCD and our goals and statutes and rules. But under the measure, the definition of land use regulation is actually very broad. Specifically calls out agricultural practices and forest practices, but also potentially implicates a number of other agencies in the work that they do as well. So recognizing that DAS serves a risk management function for the state, it was seen as being appropriate that they receive what come in as initially demands for compensation. That's what a Measure 37 claim starts with, is a demand for compensation. So that seemed to work well. We set up a rule whereby DAS is to receive these claims, and then using the rule, they make a preliminary determination of completeness, just to make sure that there is enough information in the claim to evaluate. name and address, what the regulation is that's being complained of.
Elaine, are these claims that have gone to a county first, or are these just claims that are being filed solely with the state?
Mr. Chair, both. The measure is unclear. It's been one of the hardest things to get our hands around, in part because where the measure addresses who has the authority and who has the responsibility to deal with the claim for compensation or authority to waive, the measure says it twice and it uses different language in both places, and so it's hard to reconcile. What has developed has been a standard of best practices that we've recommended, that counties recommend uniformly, and that even the proponents recommend, that where you have regulations that may be both county and state level, that is a county ordinance, for instance, that implements a state planning goal or statute, and then the state statute or goal, best practices to file a claim in both places. And so what we see are claims coming in to us relating in many cases to farm forest zones that have county components, but they'll have filed the county claim separately, and they'll be proceeding on parallel tracks. We certainly do have state regulations that have no local counterpart. For instance, a claim that might come in against the Forest Practices Act or Department of Agriculture, some of those would not have a local component, but typically ours do. And so we only deal with the state. We leave it to the local governments to evaluate their own ordinances. We make the evaluation of the state. What happens, if I can get back to the process, DASH makes this determination. Part of the determination includes what agency is responsible for this claim, and then they refer the claim out to the regulating entity. As of yesterday, the state had received 177 claims. 76 of those have been, so far, passed on to DLCD that we are in the process of reviewing. Of the remainder, so there are 177 in, 76 are already at DLCD. Of the remainder, all but three appear to relate to DLCD as well. So we should be getting the rest of those, and of course those claims are coming in on a daily basis. We have 180 days, of course, to evaluate and make a decision on each of those. We're working under that timeline. There's always the possibility, of course, of legislative intervention. I know both of the House and Senate Land Use Committees are looking at Measure 37. I'm engaged in conversation with them about that, but for right now, we're proceeding on the assumption that that first claim that came in has got to be dealt with at the end of 180 days. We have...
Yes, Senator Bates.
Just to let you know, we have... five people at the department who have been essentially their responsibilities have been augmented with responsibility to review ballot measure 37 claims. We got funding authorization from eBoard in January. We brought on two limited duration positions that are devoted solely to ballot measure 37 claims. The question, of course, for us, and I think ultimately will be for you, is what does the future hold in the way of that demand? It's too hard for me to see in that crystal ball. That's going to depend on legislative action and the flow of claims. We know that we're looking at probably 1,000 claims now, roughly, statewide, if you look at counties and cities, anticipating that most of those would involve claims that should come to the state as well. We expect this number to be increasing over time. So it's going to, absent some legislative intervention, I think this is going to be with us as a substantial new element of our workload for the foreseeable future.
Representative Krieger.
Wayne, I've been following this right along for years, and I've always felt that I support a land use system, planning system. But when we develop 30 years of rules, I think those who had control of the process, and you can point fingers forever, forget the pointing fingers, weren't very attentive to the needs of people and the constitutional property rights issues. And then we ended up with seven, now we end up with this. And I have some concern that if this isn't handled properly, we could end up with additional measure, which in my mind, if brought forward properly, could even put us in a worse position to try to protect certain types of resource lands and all the issues surrounding it. And I see people working in the process now to some degree. I'm not saying your agency, but there is in the process trying to thwart the will of the people. And that's, to me, that is the most foolish thing we can do right now. We need to be bringing all those people in and having the discussions and point figures and have coffee and sit down and hammer some of this out to avoid some of this. And there's this, and there is the distrust with stakeholders, and you've got to try to overcome that over time. Do you think you're going to get that done? Even in the billing, we know so much of what's acceptable to the House isn't acceptable to the Senate, and vice versa. If we walk out of the billing, we may be going to some court cases in the near future that are maybe from the court we're going to be giving the legislature direction as to what this really means. Do you see that coming down that way eventually?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, you've asked a number of questions in there, and I'll try to respond. I think clearly there's no question but that ballot measure 37 is a reaction to. I'm sure that you know, like many ballot measures, you can parse them, you can analyze them for any number of reasons, but I think we have to be upfront and acknowledge that a strong element of the vote for ballot measure 37 is a reaction to what may be seen as the excesses of the regulatory element of the land use planning program over the past 30 years. And as I said, 30 years ago when we established this program, it was a public process. There were more than 10,000 people involved statewide in developing the land use planning goals. And it was, by today's standards, a pretty transparent program. You had a few statutes, the goals, some administrative rules. Over time, I think the regulatory element took over the vision of the program. I think we were pretty clear on the vision to begin with. And it's natural that over time it would become a more regulatory system. And frankly, I don't think that we did a very good job of maintaining the sense of the vision, and it's just easy to fall into that regulatory mode. And clearly, I think from the public's perception, the program became a lot more about what you can't do than why we have land use planning, what the benefits of it are, why it's good. And I think because of that, we lost a lot in the way of public support for the vision that gave us the land use planning program in the first place. So I would agree with you to that extent on ballot measure 37. As to where we are now, there is no question but that there are significant issues of interpretation and implementation under the measure. We are doing our best to implement it with the advice of the Department of Justice, of course, as very best we can, assuming that in the worst case scenario that we just have to deal with what's on the page, and there won't be any clarification, and we just have to implement it as written. And we will do that. We will do our very best to do that and respect the measure. By the same token, we have been very upfront with your land use committees, I've been in front of them regularly about the issues that we're seeing arising under the measure, to give them time and opportunity to address legislatively, I think, some of the clarifications and perhaps corrections that may be needed in order to make the measure implement, perhaps as it was intended. I am also meeting regularly with interest groups from the proponents of the measure to cities and counties, private development interests, realtors, everybody that will talk to me about this measure. And I want to say I don't mean to be overly optimistic, but I'm hopeful that the recognition will be clear enough in this session of the problems so that we can find our way to a solution to nail this down, because frankly, if it doesn't, you're right, the clarification will come through a series of court cases across the state, and that's going to create chaos, because those will evolve over all of the separate judicial districts around the state until you get some clarification ultimately in the Court of Appeals or perhaps Supreme Court, and that could be 4 to 5 years down the road before you get there. And I'll tell you, if there's anything that puts economic development at risk, it's uncertainty in our land use planning program. Absolutely. When folks don't know what the rules are, they're not going to play the game.
Can't make that investment.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I spoke at a conference a couple of weeks ago with a developer, an attorney who represents major developers in the state, who said as much, that when Measure 37 was on the books, they looked at it and saw it as maybe an opportunity that they could use for their clients. Their concerns about it are significant enough that he's advising his clients, and he said most of the attorneys and consultants that he knows that represent major developers are advising their clients not even to go there because of the uncertainty. And in fact, it's coming around the back end. He referred to a development, I think, on the coast where he had a client investing some real money for a very, very high-end development, and their concern was that it appears that their property may be next to a Measure 37 claim property, and they're concerned that now having developed the planning on this one piece, they don't know what's going to happen next door to them, what the impacts could be on transportation, on the amenities, and so it just goes to underscore the sense that uncertainty is absolutely antithetical to economic development, and we need to know what those rules are, and the sooner the better. And I absolutely agree with you with that, and I'm making myself available to every meeting and conversation I can get to on ballot measure 37.
Okay, Senator Bates, I'm in Representative Shaw.
Thank you. Lane, welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glad to see you again. You've not lost your silver tongue, and I appreciate that. As I said, I thought, Shirley and Naughton. There goes the agency. But congratulations to both of you here. You know, I have high respect for both of you. I've got one short question, one long question. I'd like to ask the long question a couple days when you're back here. My first concern was, you know, obviously you're placed in a position, and shortly thereafter ballot measure 37 passes, and you're probably wondering what you got yourself into again. Jumping out of the legislature into this, I'm not sure you've moved in the right direction at all. Do you think you have the problem?
Now I can at least make a living.
Yeah.
Yeah. By August, you'll feel the same.
Yeah. He killed himself on PERS, then he joined PERS. You know, it doesn't make any sense at all here. I mean,
third tier, Mr.
Yes, you're third tier. Could have been at least second tier. Now you're just playing tiers, right?
Yeah.
The question is really pretty simple. We don't know what 37 is going to do to your agency and what your demands are going to be. I've seen you working a lot down in our county, and I imagine you've been all over the state with the amount of time you spent there. I do appreciate your work. I assume that what you did was we had a couple county commissioners telling everybody, don't file the state, you don't need to. We had one county commissioner say, file both places. I think you came down and helped clear the air there, and I appreciate that. I think a lot of people could have been hurt by not filing in both places, so I appreciate you coming down. Do you think you have adequate funding and adequate personnel to look at this onslaught you're facing? You mentioned two FTEs. I looked at your budget. It's really flat from last time around. And your agency is facing, from my point of view, two major hurdles. One, you're trying to change the face of this agency and do it fast. If you'd been there 5 years ago, we might not have gotten a 37, quite frankly. So you're trying to make this huge change, which takes a lot of time and convincing a lot of people that you really have changed, that you're proactive, you're going to help, all the things you've talked about. At the same time, you have to deal with ballot measure 37. You're getting all kinds of work to do on that. So the bottom line here is, do you really think you have adequate personnel to get this job done as it's coming at you right now? Second question, so you know what it is, this is for a couple days from now. That's something we might talk about if you're going to be in Medford this weekend.
Yeah.
About 12 o'clock, Ashland Bakery, Jackie Dingfeller, Al Bates, Elaine Chetterly, about whether or not all these agencies we look at that have these overlapping responsibilities, if in fact this is the best way to approach this. I'd like to have you talk to us about that Saturday and Monday. Okay?
Great.
So there's an opportunity for you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, is it 12 noon or 12 midnight?
12 noon.
Okay, thank you.
We'd like to catch you sober for a change.
Now, Senator, that was uncalled
for. Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffer will be there at midnight.
Sober or not? No, just
seriously. Could you ask this the first question? How do you feel about accuracy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bates, that is the question of the hour. Our budget development went through spring and summer and really was done before ballot measure 37 came onto the scene. So if you look for it in the budget documents, you won't find it, and I'm sure that's the case of every agency that's potentially implicated. Experience is showing us that, I think, as I mentioned, 177 claims in so far, three of them are not ours. So I think experience is demonstrating that the biggest budget impact is going to be on DLCD. That's probably no surprise. Is it enough? I can't tell you yet. And I hope in round one or phase one of this budget development, I'm not going to be held to that. We're watching these numbers. We hope that we'll be able to see a discernible trend and get a sense as we begin to work these first 100 or so claims through of exactly what the workload is going to be. Some of them will come in for a single house on a piece of EFU. Usually pretty straightforward. Some of them are going to be for complex development involving multiple regulations, maybe complex ownership issues, dates of acquisition. And in the beginning, we're going to be spending a lot more time per claim than we expect we will over time. So we're still in that learning curve. If you're asking me, is the budget sufficient to do everything that we are showing you that we want to do, plus Measure 37 as we expect it to implement, barring any legislative intervention, I would say right now I would be hard-pressed to say yes. We might be able to use those same dollars, but instead of 30-year review, instead of some of those other things that we've asked for in our policy option packages, that may be money that we just have to devote to ballot Measure 37. By the same token, it'll be the last thing I do basically surrender the other focuses that I've touched on, economic development and culture and all those other things. We need to do those too. We cannot just become the ballot Measure 37 processing agency or we will have lost the war. If anything, ballot Measure 37 underscores the need to continue the work that we've begun in the last year. Again, in order to maintain our emphasis on economic development maintain rationality and predictability in the program. So we're committed to doing everything, and we will let you know through staff and through the work of your committee as we develop a better sense of what that means in terms of our resources. Yeah.
Okay, Representative Schaffler. Yeah, very briefly, it's more of a comment than anything. I support well-planned, well-thought-out growth and development as a planning commissioner, city councilor, and I think you framed it really well here today, but I hope your staff, while going around, remembers, and I oppose Measure 37, but I just hope folks remember what brought us to this uncertain position, and in my opinion, it was a rigidity and flexibility in land use. In my opinion, that may be real, that may be imagined, but I think that perception about Oregon was already out there. Now we have this uncertainty. I just hope your staff, while going around the state, doesn't blame lack of investment on the uncertainties brought about just by Measure 37. That's because I traveled around the state last interim, and believe me, Lane, you do have a silver tongue. I have great respect for you. I loved working with you here, and I do miss you, but I'm glad you are where you are. But your department was, that one poor fella in Hermiston, he was one guy showed up, there were 100 people, and 35 people, they just came up and bashed your department. And for whatever reason they did, that was a pretty indication to me that there was some problem. And so I just want to make, you did it well, you framed it well, you qualified everything perfectly, but the uncertainties and the fear of investment here in the state of Oregon that have been brought on by Measure 37 were, I just want folks to remember why 37 came up in the first place. And I think you're going in the right direction, and I commend you there, but that rigidity, that inflexibility, whether real or imagined, that's what I want to concentrate on. People do invest here.
If I may respond to that, because you raised some good points, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler. Again, coming in as the new guy on the block, what I heard in my travels around the state, and as you can tell from where we've been, 34 out of the 36 counties, I think it was actually. We don't just go to where they love us. We go to the tough places too.
Where would that be?
Home. Every night at 6:30. No, yeah. So I've been at some of those meetings as well, and I'll tell you. First of all, I think. It's you have to go there if you're going to win their respect. You've got to be willing to show up at those meetings and deal with them in their communities. Secondly, what I've found is, as you know, to no surprise, reality is always more complicated than perception. A lot of that reaction against the department, if we say against our field representative at the Hermiston meeting, is often really that's focus of a reaction against maybe the program, maybe against the statutes, maybe against the history that isn't necessarily the department itself. But the department, of course, implements this program, and so to the extent that people, that there's dissatisfaction with the program, they'll focus that on the department. To be honest, in some cases, it also involves decisions that have been made locally. But I know from my experience on the Revenue Committee for four terms, folks often don't distinguish between local and state government, and we can't expect them to. Government is government, and so we all need to be working well together. But it's all those things intermixed. And I'll tell you, I know the field representative to whom you are referring. I believe he may be the bravest man in Eastern Oregon.
I thought he was.
Yeah, because he goes back. And I'll tell you, yeah, you know, and he, if you couldn't get a better, you couldn't cast a better field rep for Eastern Oregon than that. He is from Eastern Oregon. I think he has the circle in his pocket from the chewing tobacco that, he relates. Frankly, he's brave. He's not afraid to take that on and represent the department very well. I'm very proud of him. And he's actually, we're making inroads. We're making progress.
Thank you. Lane, continue on with the process of how the claims work. To recap so far, yeah. A claim gets made both at the county level. If it's just made at the county level, it still comes up to the LCD? Or goes into DAS first?
Mr. Chair, yes. All claims that come into the state go to DAS first. Sometimes we'll get a claim because someone will just... They'll see that it's a land use planning rule or goal. They'll mail a claim to us or fax a claim in. In order to keep the process true, we take that claim to DAS and have them run it through first because they're doing the data tracking. They're keeping it. We don't want to lose these things by having them come in at multiple portals of entry. So they do come in to DAS, and we deal with the state component. What we're finding is we're finding often there's give and take between us and the local folks because sometimes they may have information about the property or about other on the ground aspects of a claim. So we'll work with local planners or folks that have information for us. Where we need more information on a claim that comes in, we're not afraid to contact the claimant themselves and ask them for information. We would rather do that than get to the end of 180 days and deny a claim so we just don't have the information. If we can get the information we need, we ask for it and we get it. And it seems to be going well so far, I guess, for something that we are constructing in process. I think we're doing a good job. And for the most part, our relationships with local governments is good. It's uneven, better in some places than other. But I do meet every week with representatives of the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities and legal counsel for those organizations, and we talk through issues that are out in the counties or out in the cities, and so far have been able through that to avoid push points that could have become more difficult.
Representative Krieger.
Lane, can you tell us the structure of a claim? What's it look like? I come to you and I've got, whatever I got, this is what I want to do. What's the process that
sure.
I go through with you? Do you have a standard form?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, we do. And you can find it either through our website or through the DAS website. It is a form that just by filling it out guides you to the information that we need. And it's pretty straightforward. I think of the claims that I have seen around the state among local governments, it is one of the easier claims process to navigate. Name, property address, we ask for information about the regulation that they are basing their claim on that restricts the use, some evidence of the impact on the value of the property, and not much more than that. Because what we found, actually, the first iteration of the rule was that unintentionally we were asking for information that was just kind of difficult for people to get. We'd ask for a specific citation, for instance, to a rule or statute. And what we might get on a form at DAS was EFU. Well, and DAS doesn't know what EFU is, and so they'd be putting those in the incomplete file. We sent our folks over and said, we know what EFU is. We know what that means. We don't need a citation to a goal or a rule. And so we've actually amended our claims processing rule to even shorten the information that we absolutely require. I'll say what we don't require. The state does not require a filing fee. The state does not require an appraisal be submitted with the property. Those are things that you see out in some of the counties and cities. We do not. Of course, the trade-off is that means then it comes out of general fund resources because that's where the cost is borne to process those. But I think we've done a good job of making it fairly straightforward, and I'd encourage you to take a look at the website. Again, you can get there either through ours or through the DAS website, that claim form, and we've made a real effort to make the claims process as easy to navigate as possible.
Yeah.
I hate to belabor this, but Vince, I've got you right here.
Yeah.
A tree farm, been forest grazing land, but there's 60 acres with an ocean view, and maybe today I may not want to do it. Maybe 10 years, 20 years, maybe. And we're talking about the transferability that to my family and the children and the investment that we've made for the last 30-some years. Can you talk to us a little about filing now for a future date, or what happens if I die before that date, that type of thing, about having the opportunity to do that sometime later?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Krieger, this goes to legal advice from the Department of Justice, and I'll explain the language of the measure that gets to this conclusion, but the interpretation of the measure is that what we're calling a waiver under the measure, that is a decision by government to not apply, to modify, or remove a land use regulation, is not transferable. It's personal to the applicant. And the reason, I could bring Richard Whitman from DOJ in to give you the better legal analysis. In this world, I'm the client, not the lawyer, and I'm happy to be. But in the measure, what it says is that in lieu of paying compensation, a government may modify, remove, or not apply, waive, a land use regulation. But then it goes on to say, so as to permit the owner of the property, and owner is defined in Section 11 as the present owner, to use the property for a use that would have been permitted when the owner acquired title. And so that language referring to owner, which is, again, very narrowly defined as in the measure itself as the present owner, as well as the reference to use of the property that the owner may have put, coupled with some other things, and again, I don't want to speak for DOJ, but gets to their opinion that a waiver under the measure is not a transferable right. If you build, if you get a waiver and you go ahead and build, it's not a situation it's something then of a non-conforming use, which is legal. So your children wouldn't have to tear it down. It would continue to be allowed as a use. But that is a question that both your Senate and House committee chairs are very well aware of, as one that at the very least needs clarification.
Some controversy there, and this is another one of those places where if we aren't careful, here comes another measure, and it may go beyond what you think you got now.
Oh, I understand. I understand. I'll tell you, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, and this is why this is one of the first issues we brought to the legislative committees to raise as a point under the measure, because frankly, if it almost doesn't matter what the DOJ says, and I don't mean that to diminish the value of their legal advice, but they're not the final say. That's right. It will still remain unsettled because until a court, barring any legislative clarification, until a court actually settles the question, there are still going to be two sides to that argument, no matter which side we're on.
Okay, so Lane, if a claim is filed only at the county level, not the state level, does it ever come up to the state level, or does it stay there at the county and they make the decision?
Mr. Chair, it depends.
You got to clarify that.
I like that.
Clears my leg.
This is reading between the lines and the measure upside down and inside out. But one of the reasons that both, again, the proponents as well as the state and I think consistently local governments have recommended that claimants file in both places. Here is the risk. If a claimant files with the county only, and let's assume that this is a regulation that has a state overlay, $80,000 income tax,
right,
whatever it may
whatever.
Be. Yeah. County says, we'll waive. County can do that. Then the claimant never files a request or a waiver or a claim, I should say, at the state and never does obtain a state waiver. What if, and this is right now, this is only what if because it's not happening out there, but the risk to the property owner is what if the county then goes ahead without a state waiver and issues a building permit? First of all, if that property owner goes to a bank, they're liable to find some resistance for bank financing for the construction, which at a minimum then is going to put the property owner through another delay of having to start all over again and file with the state. It also, we believe, may leave the property owner subject to third-party action, even by a private plaintiff, with a state regulation still in force on their property that's not been waived. And I can't say that definitively, but that certainly is a risk out there for that property owner. And so really, rather than encounter those risks, I think everyone is saying for now, file them in both places. Just file it, get the process done once, because, again, the risk is potential liability or, at a minimum, having to go back and start over again when you get to a point where you can't get to where you thought you could with just one waiver. So it's very much in the interest of the claimant to get those two waivers.
Yeah.
We're not trying to control anything here. We're trying to make sure that folks aren't frustrated or put at risk by not getting a waiver decision where they need it.
So is it a possible scenario, or maybe it's already occurred, I don't know, is it a possible scenario that a person could file with both places, a county and a state? County grants a waiver, state says no. Has that happened, or is that possible that it would happen? And then what happens if it does?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, good question. No, it's not happened.
Okay.
Is there a risk? Yeah, I suppose so. Where would it come? Typically, I suppose what could be at risk would be maybe the state would take a position, or of course, it could always be reversed too. I don't want to assume that one level of government is going to make one decision and one another, because this could go either way. So we'll just say one level of government may allow a waiver, and one may look at it and say, well, wait a minute, we think that the regulation being complained of here, or on which this is based, is exempt. Maybe as a pollution control regulation or required by federal law. I don't know what would happen at that point. I don't think it is an issue that would put the county and state at loggerheads. I think it would, probably what would happen, let's just play this out. Somebody files, and I hope DOJ is not listening because I'm making this up.
it is being taped.
So, let me add the appropriate disclaimer here that I am treading on thin ice. Here's the scenario that I can see playing out that you suggest. Applicant files an application. County says, go for it. state looks at it and says, whoa, no, we think that there is a maybe an ownership issue or a question of an exemption from the measure that says that, in fact, this regulation should not be subject to compensation or waiver. I don't see that as putting the state and county so much at odds. Probably at that point, what the claimant's remedy would be to wait out their 180 days under the measure, and if the regulation is still in place, file a claim in circuit court against the state and have it determined that way. I mean, that is the relief that's provided for in the measure. And if you file a claim and the government doesn't either compensate or remove the regulation within 180 days, you file your suit in circuit court to recover the amount of compensation plus attorney fees and costs, and I would expect that's probably how that one would be resolved.
And that would be the same whether a county or the state both denied a claim. What happens if a claim is denied, then the claimant has the remedy is they have the opportunity to make a decision to file that.
Yes.
They may or may not sue, but they will have that opportunity.
They do in court.
Okay. Yes, additional questions? Senator Bates.
This is kind of probably a strange question, but it's me. what do you expect? Have you actually had a chance to finish any claims yet, and what was the outcome?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we have not. We've got some that are very close to finish. But since these are all being run through the first time, even the most basic, what will over time become the most basic questions, we're having looked at by DOJ. So we've not issued any final decisions. I can tell you we don't have any checks written waiting to pay compensation.
They have the money.
We can write an IOU. I think that would go really.
I remember last session when Representative Williams used to carry his wallet around and tell everyone it was the ending fund. Sort of where we are on our compensation fund in the department.
Additional questions, members?
And if I may, I'm sorry,
please.
Mr. Chair, but another reason, too, is we know that both House and Senate committees are looking at this measure,
yeah.
and we're a little bit. We don't want to disadvantage a property owner, for instance, if a legislative clarification could enhance their claim. By the same token, we don't want to step out too far the other direction either. So we're interested to see if legislative clarification might come through and actually help the evaluation of some of these claims.
A follow-up question that's occurred to me. One of the committees is discussing the possibility of extending the 180-day limit another 180 days so they have more time to consider this and potentially come up with a compromise that might be more acceptable to people and might be clearer. Have you had those discussions yet, and what's your feelings on it, if you have any? But you're the one handling the claims. I mean,
yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, it's hard for me not to grasp at that straw. By the same token, I think in fairness to claimants, unless I think a condition for an extension of that time really would have to be that there is a serious effort underway that's probable of success to actually achieving some legislative clarification. I would not be one to go in and just ask for that off the bat and say, give us this time and then let's talk about it. I think if we were to appoint, if we being me, you, all the interested parties that would be involved in negotiations, if we are to the point where it really is a serious effort and it's just a matter of nailing down the language and then recognizing that it might take beyond that 180th day of the first claim, that would be an appropriate time, I think, to look at that, but only then, in fairness to claimants.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Clarify, Lane, to the best of your understanding from DOJ's advice, in talking about waivers and transferability of them, owner is defined as present owner.
Correct.
So if land is passed on to heirs, are heirs considered present owners, or are they considered original owners?
Mr. Chair, do you mean the descendants of the next generation, my kids?
Precisely. If you had purchased, let me give you an example of my grandparents. bought our home farm in the 1930s, long before land use planning, and began transferring, all the assets were placed in a family corporation, began transferring stock over a period of years prior to land use planning and implementation, would they then be considered, because they're partially owners, would they be considered present owners at the time that land use planning? I mean,
the chart must answer because
right. Oh, Mr. Chair, you have asked a complicated question. First of all, if they transferred the property to a corporation, the question is the corporation now the owner? So it almost doesn't. Shareholders come and go. Is the corporation the owner? Let's take that aside. Let's pare back about a corporation. If owner is determined as of the determination of ownership is critical for the date on which a regulation became effective that restricts the use and reduces the value. So if that conveyance of property had occurred over a period of time, and then at a point in time after these interests had been created, let's say an individual deeds out to various children and other family members, they all would be considered owners for the purpose of a claim because they had an ownership interest in the property when the regulation that they're complaining of became effective.
But the actual if you had purchased land prior to Senate Bill 100 coming in, let's say for the sake of argument, and then you had passed on, could your children make the claim for any ability to do anything with that land prior to Senate Bill 100?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, Senate Bill 100 itself didn't create any. It created the mechanism, basically, for the regulation. So what you would look at would be the effective dates of whatever regulation you're complaining of. I say complaining of. It's pejorative. Every regulation under which you are filing your claim. That's the critical date. So whether you owned your property or the children had title before or after the effective date of Senate Bill 100 really is almost irrelevant. The question is, what use do you want to put the property to today that is limited by a regulation, and when did that regulation become effective? For instance, if it's under the $80,000 income test, that goes back to, 1993? I think. So ownership prior to 1993 would be considered ownership prior to the effective date of the $80,000 income test. And so what you've had over time is a series of regulations that have become effective as either statutes have been adopted, rules have been adopted, or goals have been adopted and thereafter amended. So that's one of the things we do in our claims. We look at the use, the regulation that they're complaining of, the date on which that regulation became effective, and then you apply that against the ownership records and who owned the property at what point in time.
So the children then are not considered to be the heirs of that land, who've inherited that land, are not considered to be the original owners of that land prior to any regulation coming into effect, correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's right. Let me put it this way. Under the measure, and I'm going to qualify again this as being without authoritative clearance from DOJ, but I've spoken with and attended conferences that the proponents have spoken about this issue. Basically, what it says is that a person today can file a claim for compensation based on prior family ownership. So that if Grandpa bought the farm, acquired the property, he's 19. if Grandpa acquired the property in 1930, and let's say you inherited it last year.
Right.
Okay. The measure says that, appears to say, and this is what the proponents say that they intended, that if you acquired the property by inheritance from Grandpa, you can file a claim for compensation based on the whole array of regulations that have come into effect limiting the use of your property from the date that Grandpa acquired the property. But there is a difference in between what you may claim in the way of compensation and what you may be entitled to for waiver. Because, again, the language for waiver says that in lieu of paying compensation, the government may waive the regulations to allow the owner, and all of a sudden now that's you, that's the present owner, that's the specific definition, to use the property for use that may have been permitted when you acquired the title. So now you may have a huge claim for compensation that can be waived back to last year.
Right.
Which doesn't get you much in terms of actual use of the property. Dave Honeycutt spoke at a program in Portland, and I've heard it more than once, in saying that was drafted intentionally to achieve that result, made for their own purposes. But that was their intent in the way that prior family ownership works.
Okay.
Now, we haven't gotten final clarification on that DOJ reads it the same way, but that at least is one reading of the measure and how the drafters said that they intended the measure to work.
Any further questions? All right, why don't we move on to mercilessly to performance measure.
Okay. If I may, I'll ask Bob Rindy, our performance measure guru, to join me up here at the table.
I've never thought of you, Bob, as a guru, but that's...
I think of myself as a swami, maybe, but not a guru. I don't know the difference.
Okay, for the record, stay here.
My name is Bob Rindy, and I'm a policy analyst in the director's office.
One moment, please. Members, please turn to the white tabs under C. Tab number C, probably starting at page number 6 or wherever Bob would like to start. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we would like to give a few introductory remarks. Lane, were you going to do that? Or I can.
No, yeah, I'll be happy to. First, I think it's important as you look at the, I'll just make a comment generally about several of the performance measures that you see. And we'll remind you as we get to them, but they're performance measures number 1, 3, 4, 5, and 10. They are performance measures that are related to periodic review. That is how a major way in which we collect the data to measure and determine how well we are doing on these performance measures. That being the case, these measures are affected by and will continue to be affected by changes that the legislature makes to periodic review. That is, in exempting, for instance, cities under 2,500 in population from doing periodic review, that basically takes out a whole set of cities from these measurements. To the extent that grant, and I should also mention that periodic review is also a function of grant funding. So to the extent that grant funds are reduced, cities will be able to do less in periodic review. Those are all kind of the hydraulics that are going to affect these measures, both in terms of what you see, but also into the future. So as we go through these, we may have some conversation, perhaps not an immediate biennium coming forward, but as going forward from there, some risks anyway as to the viability of the long-term targets because of potential changes to periodic review. Okay.
Thank you, Lane. Yes, on page 6 and 7, you'll see the first measure. By the way, we did end up renumbering many of these because we renumbered or changed the order of some of our goals. I'm going to go through them as they appear in tab C, which is our annual performance progress report, but I may refer you to tab D occasionally because some of these are certainly a different number, but also some of these we are proposing that we change or modify or drop them, and you can't see that in that document, but you would in a later tab. The first performance measure has to do with the supply of commercial and industrial land. And this is central to our most current mission. In this measure, which we developed around 2003, we are talking about a 20-year supply of land. The measure refers to urban areas that have a sufficient supply of commercial and industrial land to implement their local economic development strategy. Generally, as cities and counties go through periodic review, they evaluate their need for commercial and industrial land. As part of that, they evaluate the land that's they look at the land that's inside the urban growth boundary at the time they start periodic review. They go through something called an economic opportunity analysis to determine the kinds of and amounts of industrial and commercial land that they want in the long run, and then they often amend their urban growth boundary or make other changes to make sure they have a sufficient supply. That's a long-term supply. And I would say right away that the primary finding of a committee that legislature established and that we worked with in 2002 and 3 found that the bigger problem in the state is short-term supply. So this measure is about long-term supply. What we found also on this measure, of course there are many cities, especially the smaller cities, that have a large supply of industrial land. It's a 20-year supply and commercial land. We had no way to measure starting in we went back to 1999 to acquire data. We couldn't tell you what all those cities were. What we did instead was decide we're going to start with periodic review as we began approving those jurisdictions in 1999. We knew that at that moment, that urban area over 2,500 had a sufficient supply. And you'll see that 7% of those had a sufficient supply in 99. We continued to ramp up as we go forward to 2003 when we got our last measurement. There are probably a lot more jurisdictions that have a sufficient supply. It's just we had no way to measure that or verify that. So these numbers are low, but we are more confident of these numbers.
If I may, Mr. Chair, what these numbers reflect going back to 1999 forward, you look at that and say it's shocking that in 1999 we only had 7% of cities over 2,500 with an adequate supply. And that is not the case. I think what Bob is saying is that this is 7% over a base number. That is, we started with a number. We started with a new base. And so this measures growth over that base beginning in 1999. So that's about, I think, in 96 or 97 was about when everybody finished their first round of periodic review.
Yeah.
So we figured, okay, that's a good place to count as a base. This is growth over that base. So this is basically the second round of periodic review.
And of course, the corollary to that is that those jurisdictions that were done in 1999, as time goes by and as some of that land develops and other things happen to it, you know, this is a rolling process. Metro is required to go through periodic review at a much more frequently. So you could see that part of the 7% in 1999 was Metro. Well, they came up again in 2003. So you end up with a weighting to these numbers that may be more tilt toward Metro with the 24 cities in Metro. You'll note that we did not meet our target. Our target was 72 for 2003. We had 48% of the jurisdictions through. If Metro had been through and was close to done at that point and we had anticipated it would be, we would have met the 72%. Metro, we completed the industrial commercial land supply in 2004, although I say it's complete. The commission has tentatively approved it. There's still some steps to be made till that's final. But if it had been done a year early, we would have made the target.
A couple of points here. I'm not sure that I'd like to make this more clear in that this is a measurement of your agency working with other cities to get this done, correct?
Correct.
So What would be helpful here, because Metro, and you say in your narrative here that Metro, this is clearly weighted towards the Portland area, Portland metro area. What would be helpful for us is to have that broken out. Maybe have Metro broken out separately as a data point with the rest of the state. Because Metro obviously has their own pretty well-established schedule and planning staff to do this, and it probably takes less effort on the part of your agency to push at them. Well, I don't know, you're smirking at me. Maybe not.
Metro is exceedingly complex, and as you can guess.
So, for the purposes of us measuring your performance, it would be good to have Metro broken out, I think, from the rest of the state. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you.
And really what I'm hearing, this isn't necessarily a performance measure of you guys. This is a performance measure of somebody else.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I think that's true of a lot of these. We work with local partners. This is a measure of, you're right, it takes a city or a county to do periodic review. We also recognize it is a function of our agency to encourage, support, provide grant support, technical assistance to enable them to do that. So it is a shared process. So we do own part of this. But you're right, there is a key element of this, that is local action in actually doing the periodic review. And just to underscore again what Bob said, with Metro having, now they're late, but we've gotten them there, I think that number looks much better than it was actually reflected for a 2003.
And I would also add, a periodic review, of course, is more of a regulatory way to bring jurisdictions up to the level of having a sufficient supply. But we also have grant funding. And to the extent that we can fund local governments or help them go through the process of evaluating their supply and amending their boundary, we will be more successful. And there will be more and more jurisdictions that meet this, not because of periodic review, but because we have grant funds. As those funds change, also our ability to meet these targets change.
Mr. Chair, this really does underscore the importance of the grant fund element of our program,
yeah.
Because you mentioned Metro. Certainly they do have staff. Most of our cities and counties around the state are poorly staffed to do this. That's not a reflection on staff. That's a reflection on resources. And as part of the partnership I think we have as a state with our local governments in being able to support them in their periodic review, which is essential for their own economic development.
I was chairman of the Halsey Planning Commission in a 760-person city, and it was essential. I mean, we had no clue. Our staff had no clue, frankly, how to do these things, and were it not for grant funding, and, of course, that was before the change of the 2,500 number. Had we not had the grant funding, we would not have been able to have engaged in the process at all, at any level. We simply would have been totally lost. Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Lane already addressed one of the things I was just going to note was under the second to last question where it says what needs to be done as a result of this analysis in your last sentence. It's already covered that. Also, adequate funding of the Department's technical assistance and grant support to achieve the target. So that's back to my original point about you guys are becoming more of a technical assistance
mm-hmm.
agency.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually the last, the next paragraph, that first sentence, a new measure should be considered for certified industrial sites. And in our review of the Division of State Lands performance measure, we did have one performance measure, if I'm recalling right, about, you know, because DSL has been pretty integral in the industrial land survey. So, and I've already mentioned this about cross-linking of performance measures. We don't do that very well with other agencies, and that might be something we want to think about is reference DSL's performance measure, and I don't know the number, but because, I mean, you guys make a good point. Just because we zone for industrial land doesn't mean it's available, and it doesn't mean it's ready for development. So anyway, that's more of a statement than
okay.
You want to have any comment.
Yes, Bob. Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, yeah, we do have a new measure. I think it's now numbered as number 5.
Under tab D,
correct.
And that is addressed to project ready, which is...
Okay.
Yeah, we have 22 measures to get through. We won't obviously get through them quite today, but I did appreciate the discussion we had on Measure 37. I think there's plenty of time tomorrow to finish up performance measures, priorities,
Monday.
And reduction. Or Monday.
Thank you.
God, I'm always doing that on Thursdays. All right, let's go to number 2, if that's all the questions. Representative Schaffer.
Yeah.
Hold on, I just have one follow-up. No, I mean, so how, because I don't see the reference of this performance measure in here. So how do you connect the two? Am I just not looking at this right? So maybe you just need to reference it under this first performance measure to number 5. Is that
correct? We should do that. We're renumbering these, and right now they seem to jump around. I think, you know, and part of why we've renumbered them is there
right.
is a
okay.
better, more logical order for them.
Oh, well, this clarifies.
Yeah, that will help you connect.
Yeah, we actually will talk about order because there's some of these that kind of ought to be grouped together, perhaps.
Okay. Thank you.
Such as number two.
Yeah, exactly.
And number two is precisely. Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Shoffler.
Very, very briefly, I can understand a small town, 2,500. When I first ran for council, I think it was 2,500. And the pressure to develop there is immense still. Now I think we're at 7 or 8,000 years later. And I continue to grow maybe at that rate. And even the ring of cities around where I live, Sandy, Estacada, Morrell, Canby, Wilsonville, obviously, you can just continue it around. There I can understand why those folks would have to go through this. But and I'm sure this has been talked over and over, this number of 2,500. Up in the metropolitan areas of an I-5 corridor, I can understand it. But if you're a little town, clear out here, and you're 3,500 people, why do we explain to me that why do we make those folks go through all this review? Is that really worth their time? I can understand it's worth their time to have an idea where they would put industry if someone were going to come out and invest that. That I agree with, but this is a long, complex process that takes quite a bit of resources to do. Why do we make those folks go through all that? Why arbitrarily 2,500?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, first of all, credit review is a process which begins with a give and take where the state and the local government negotiate sometimes for quite a while as to really what are the most important things for that particular community to update in their plan. And in your example, that community of 3,500 may very well be able to we may conclude that negotiation that community doesn't need to do this. It would be my guess would be that more and more communities are seeing the value of having an adequate supply of land to attract employment. So I don't think it's the case that many of them will opt out. But if they really did want to opt out and spend their time in Parac Review doing some other things, and often that's the case, the Parac Review program does allow for that flexibility.
Mr. Chair, this was hit home to me one of our out in the state LCDC meetings, where a commissioner of one of our counties came and expressed some consternation to the commission that in their rural zoned areas the only commercial activity that they could allow was firewood splitting. And it was in conversation with him that, well, in fact, that's your own code that limits you to firewood splitting. Periodic review is the process, you know, that allows them to take that 30-year-old code out and update it for things that are appropriate today. And so it is important, even in small communities, because that's what helps them position themselves for growth. And it is one of these things that is not a one-size-fits-all proposition. It is tailored to the community and to what the foreseeable needs of the community are. They have significant input on what goes into periodic review.
Okay, let's go to number two. Thank you.
And this one does jump around, perhaps out of order, at least in this report. The estuarine areas that are designated as development management units are areas that some time ago were designated as areas that would be good, and they are scarce, for deep water ports. The program, the goal, is written in order to try and maintain those areas, even if today they are not deep water ports, and there is pressure to turn them into other things, where there may be many areas along the coast that would serve, for example, for housing or commercial development. This particular measure is geared towards our attempt to try and preserve those areas over time to allow for future development of deep water ports. They're unique. They should be conserved for that use. And this simply shows that, at least in the time period we've got here, none of those have converted to some other use. If they were developed as a deep water port, then they would still be.
A couple of comments here. We'd like to have you add to this measure exactly how many sites we're talking about. Percentages are great, but it'd be nice to know how many of those are there. And I was curious about the wording of this performance measure, and it sort of goes along with what you just said, Bob, in terms of retaining that designation. I guess just from practical experience, that once something gets zoned a particular way, it's bloody hard to change it under the current rules that we seem to be operating under. So, I mean, how easy is it to change an estuarine area, to change its designation? I mean, is this really something we need to be concerned about?
Mr. Chair, the pressure is there, and there is maybe not frequent, but there have been many conversations with our staff where there are proposals, shall we say, to rezone these, and in part you can recognize that once we designate a site for industrial, no development shows up after a while, of course there is more and more interest to have that turn into something else. And that happens to a lot of industrial land throughout the state as it sits for a long periods of time with no takers coming along, that it may tend to convert to some other use. In this case, we are particularly concerned about these because these, over time, you can't replace these. Once you lose a potential deep water port site, they're not making any more. And if they turn to condos, which might, in the short run, be something that could immediately turn a profit on that property, you've probably lost the opportunity down the road for more industrial development. That's why we singled these out. And again, I think it also it's singled out in the sense that it just unfortunately came up as a second measure. If you saw this in relation to some of the other coastal measures, and this is one of those that is probably, in fact, we've renumbered it to number 9.
Okay. And have any been converted?
I will have to get back to you on that. I know that we have been in a fairly lengthy discussion with Newport over proposal. I don't think no current status.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we'll check on that. I think that would not have been in 2003. It may have been something even ongoing with Newport. And actually they've been very productive negotiations with the city. But we'll get back and come back with Monday on a report on what's going on in Newport.
Given the difficulties of navigating the minefield, not pun, channel deepening and those things in the Columbia, and the incredible federal issues you have to go through to even think about deepening, say, Yaquina Bay to become a deep water port seems like almost an insurmountable hurdle, to be honest with you. Over and above your process, it's all of the other regulatory issues that come into play. Is this a reality to be able to actually make it another deep water port in this state?
Mr. Chair, I think the answer is probably not, which is why we put such a high premium on protecting the deep water ports, you know, and measuring that with this goal. So to the extent that it is difficult to change the zoning on these water development properties, I think that's a policy decision that's been made some time ago, that it's appropriate. It'd be very hard to do that because, as Bob says, once it's gone, it's gone, and I don't think we would foreseeably expect to be able to develop new deep water facilities. So I don't think we would anticipate that being part of a development future. That's why the premium is put on protecting the deep water sites that we already have.
Okay, very good. Representative Shoffley?
Yeah. Newport, are you talking about, I saw years ago we stayed at, I think it's the Embarcadero down there. They were loading logs, unfortunately, instead of milled lumber, onto a ship down there. Is that where you're talking about? And is that going to turn into condos, or are you going to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, I want to say no. I think it's on the south, and it's not condos. We'll get back to you with the whole Newport update on this. Very, very interesting, and I think another success story with our working with local government.
Sure. I hope someday we do return to not just shipping logs out, but even more logs and more milled lumber. That's just an editorial there, but that's what I'd like to see happen. Forgive me.
Very good. Let's move on to number 3, please.
We are this measure again is talking about residential land, and it's sort of the counterpart of number 1. The land use program is set up in order to make sure that there is a 20-year supply of land for housing in urban growth boundaries. again, probably many, many more jurisdictions in 1999 than the 7% you see here had a 20-year supply of housing land, but we couldn't verify that, so we've started with the baseline there, and as periodic review rolled through the years that you see with the data there, we each of those jurisdictions over 2,500 completed periodic review and indeed had a 20-year supply of land for residential use.
Well, I'd like to have you also add the breakout for Metro on this one also because of that weighting towards that. And it'd be good if you move this up to be congruent with or adjacent to that other one there.
You may note that the numbers look very similar to the ones for performance measure number one until you get to 2003. Metro completed their housing portion of their periodic review, and that's why we met that target. We had hoped that they would have got the industrial land done at the same time, and they didn't, but that's
I'm going to hand the gavel for a moment to Senator Bates.
I have to wake up.
Don't hurt anybody.
We're adjourned now. Early and,
no, just go to work session.
Yeah. Here's your budget.
What's that?
Here's your budget.
Here's your budget. Please continue.
Moving on to measure four, there's no questions further on that one. Every local government that evaluates their land supply in order to make sure they have enough land for 20 years worth of industrial, commercial, and residential has to take into account land that probably isn't buildable. And generally that's anything from wetlands to hazard areas, floodways, et cetera. One of the issues, and I think that's led to this measure, number four, is that over the years, there's been kind of spotty conformance to what is now a clear requirement that we adopted in 1995, that as a jurisdiction evaluates their land supply, they should not call wetlands and certain other kinds of lands that are protected buildable land, even though they're zoned, whether it's industrial or residential. And so what we're trying to do here, and this began in 95, unfortunately the 95, for whatever reason, the 1995 rules were triggered so that jurisdictions going into periodic review wouldn't really meet those until 2003. So we began in 2003. You see there that there's it says 3%. I'll get to that in a minute. It should have said 4%. That is an error. But 4% of the jurisdictions had made this accounting correctly so that lands that are not buildable are taken out of their supply and that they have a 20-year supply of land that's really buildable. As we go forward, you'll see that we'll ultimately ramp up where more and more of the jurisdictions have done that accounting. But we didn't really get started on it, unlike the previous measures that started in 99. We didn't get started on that until 2003. I don't know how this error occurred. If you look at the narrative, you'll note that it says there's 4.1%, and in fact, that should have been the number listed under 2003, that we had actually had 4% of our jurisdictions through this process. No doubt there were many other jurisdictions that had done this accounting. They were either less than 2,500, or we just had no way to verify that. And so, just like the previous measures, we started from a baseline.
I think we can live with the 1% error.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And also, to point out the scale of the graph, all of the other graphs so far have been from 0 to 100 or 110. This one is 0 to 20, so you just need to be aware of the different scale there. It makes it look much different than it is.
Yes, Representative Dinkel.
Thank you. I guess I'm a little confused about how this benchmark is worded. Percent of urban areas that have updated buildable lands inventories. So how does that relate to a jurisdiction? I mean, is it a percentage of the jurisdiction when you say urban areas? And maybe I'm just completely reading this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, no, that I understand the confusion there. Urban areas means, has always meant to us, areas over 2,500. And in fact, We are proposing to make that adjustment to every one of these, just in the interest of transparency, that measure 3, 4, 5, and 10 should say right in the measure. You shouldn't have to find it in the data set that we're looking at measure at jurisdictions over 2,500. We would propose to change these so that you see it right away, that we're talking about over 2,500. And the reason we do that, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, it's only those jurisdictions that have to go through periodic review. But secondly, many of the requirements that we're talking about regarding economic opportunity analysis or other things, they only apply to jurisdictions over 2,500. So, there are 100 jurisdictions over urban areas, jurisdictions in urban areas over 2,500. So that means there's 140 other cities and urban growth boundaries out there. Very likely many of them have done this also. It doesn't get accounted for in this data.
Well,
that
was my follow-up question. Its target just seems awfully low.
Let me explain that as well. The PERAC review, which was changed in 2003 through Senate Bill 920, has very much reduced the emphasis on this kind of planning work locally in terms of grant dollars, in terms of our attention. The decision of the legislature at that time was that we should focus our energies and jurisdictions should focus their energies on other issues, especially industrial sites, housing sites, sufficient land supply, public facilities, and less so on identifying and protecting natural resources. Not because it's not important, but that's a lower level priority now, so we'll have far fewer grant dollars to use in that regard, and I think these numbers reflect the decreased emphasis on this work.
Just one last question, comment. I guess the disturbing part, and I worked on, and I don't know if I should even say this, but I worked on the pre-Goal 5 inventory work at Metro as a citizen. I was on the gears of work on the looking at the buildable land inventory in the Metro area. And I guess the thing that concerns me most is about the hazards area. And if we're not really up to date on our hazards area, I mean, you know, we're going to be setting ourselves up for a lot of lawsuits. And I don't know if this is, I'm trying to figure out if you're saying you don't know if that's being done because we haven't really finished going through the periodic review where it's not being done. And I can understand not having the emphasis on what you're saying about the natural areas, but certainly in the hazard areas, I would have concern about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Title
Feldman,
three.
One of our policy option packages it would provide funding for a natural hazard mapping updates for local governments. And I'd have to check and see if that would potentially change these targets. We can check on that. But geared historically as these have been to periodic review and without action in front of us to approve that policy option package, I think this does reflect the legislative directive to de-emphasize these aspects of periodic review. And so we're just seeing less of it.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Digfelder, the other thing about this is notice that the measure is written in the conjunctive. The jurisdiction has to have done both to meet this measure. Many more jurisdictions have mapped their hazard areas, but
that makes a lot more sense.
So that's that's part of the problem here. Unless they've done them both, they don't get counted.
Okay. Yeah, well, and I was going to say as a follow up, would it be worth breaking out as a separate performance measure for Goal 5 and then
we could do so
for hazard, especially if we're seeing much higher target numbers for hazard areas in Goal 5. And I'm not saying for the record that it's not just as important, because I do believe that the Goal 5 is just as important. But I think we may want to look at maybe separate performance measures. Just a thought.
Would be
thank you.
For communities under 2,500 that want to do a periodic review and all this work, do you provide them with grant money and assistance too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffman, to the extent that grant funds are available, we can do that through technical assistance.
Okay,
and we do.
All right, let's move on to number 5, please.
Number 5 has to do much more with short-term supply. Urban area, what we're trying to measure is the progress local governments have made towards planning for and funding sewer and water systems. Having a 20-year supply is not worth much if people that want to develop that land cannot get the facilities they need. And so we also, as part of our work in trying to provide adequate supply, have Goal 11, under which we encourage jurisdictions to plan for the facilities that they will need. And especially in the short term, we try, the goal aims and our rules aim for a 3 to 5 year supply of serviced land. That's the near term land that is most important, and it won't come online if cities and counties don't conduct the planning that's necessary especially to provide funding for those facilities. So we're measuring jurisdictions' progress toward that. It is somewhat of a lower priority in terms of periodic review, but it's certainly more and more, I think, is something that's got attention. And I'm currently sitting in a work group that Representative Garrard commissioned with Tom Gallagher to look at trying to bring more readily available prime industrial land online throughout the state, and they've right away zeroed in on what can we do to get more services to sites. So that's what this is about.
Okay, very good. I tell you what we're going to do. We're a couple of minutes early, but I'd like to go ahead and just kind of finish up for today, and we'll move on tomorrow. We'll finish with performance measures tomorrow, members.
Monday.
See, I just want to get this stuff done.
You just want to work.
All right, fair enough. It'll be on Monday, and we will move forward. With that, I thank you all
thank
for
you.
Coming. I appreciate the conversation today. And if I think there were a couple of small items that you could get for us for Monday, would be very helpful. And have a great weekend. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.